Two of Paris. I don't know exactly how to translate it into English, but it basically says, we can cope with waves, but you know, we will never ever sink. We will stay afloat. And I think this is also part of the message. More than ever, people across the world and in Paris need to stand up to say that they are fearless and that they want their right to public and democratic freedom of speech, and that climate change today is that one issue where we can express it. And that's why we need people to mobilize across both weeks in Paris and across the world in solidarity with us.
And are you worried that the national leaders are now so much focused after the horrible events of last week on fighting terrorism might not be as focused on the issue of the negotiations that occur at the summit?
This is a major concern indeed. We know that leaders are coming to Paris, but we're not sure whether climate change will still be the one and only priority on their agenda, and understandably so. At the same time, as I said, climate change is the symptom. The causes and consequences of climate change are connected to all of this terrorism. They're fueling terrorism. They're fueling the social instability, the world of unrest in which we live today. So to us, it makes complete sense to discuss, you know, even more so why we need to tackle climate change, why we need a strong agreement in Paris, why we need strong climate action everywhere, solidarity, financial support from developed to developing countries, a vision with no fossil fuels in the picture, and a world where there are jobs being created thanks to renewable energy and energy efficiency. So all of these issues must connect in Paris and make sure that actually now we even have more of a leverage to get a strong climate agreement in Paris.
Alex Mazzouni, we want to thank you for being with us. You're standing in front of the Place de la République, where people are showing their solidarity with those who died on Friday. Alex Mazzouni is International Policies Coordinator at the Climate Action Network France. And that does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is now 8:01. Coming up next on The Boo, Wednesday Talk Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month is the amazing Nina Simone, showing Thursday, November 19th at 7 p.m. Nina Simone was one of America's true musical geniuses. With her unique signature mix of layering folk, gospel, classical, pop, and African music, along with a revolutionary vision of Black freedom, pride, and defiance. Again, that's the amazing and revolutionary Miss Nina Simone, showing as part of the We Real Cool film series on Thursday, November 19th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Circus Church, Sunday, November 22nd, 9 p.m. at the Funhouse Lounge in Portland. There will be burlesque performers, circus artists, vocalists, audience games, confessions, and more. Again, that's Circus Church, Sunday, November 22nd, 9 p.m. at the Funhouse Lounge, 2432 Southeast 11th Avenue in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, and accessories with a focus on natural fibers since 1984. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at gazellenaturalfiberclothing.com.
And good morning. This is Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. We are going to dispense with the opening music because we have a lot to talk about today, and I just want to get right into it. We have a very special guest today, Professor Clive Spash, who's an economist who writes, researches, and teaches on public policy with an emphasis on economic and environmental interactions. He's currently chair of public policy and governance in the Department of Socioeconomics at Vienna University of Economics and Business in Austria. And that's where we'll be talking to him from. His main interests are interdisciplinary research on human behavior, environmental values, and the transformation of the world political economy to a more socially and environmentally just system. That is from his website, www.clivespash.org. Professor Spash has written extensive critiques of the dominant market-based approaches to dealing with global climate change, as well as other environmental problems. He is an environmental ecological economist, which is kind of its own subfield, and which I'm sure he'll tell us all about. Anyway, he's criticized dominant approaches to dealing with global climate change, including carbon trading. His article, Better Growth, Helping the Paris Cop Out, Fallacies and Omissions of the New Climate Economy Report, dissects the flawed thinking and approaches that will likely prevail, in my opinion, probably his, at the upcoming climate talks in Paris. And you can find that information on our website on the page for this program, Wednesday Talk Radio. And so without further ado, welcome to our airwaves, Professor Spash.
Thank you.
And how are things over in Vienna?
Oh, they're fine here. A little bit warmer than they should be, maybe.
Yeah, no doubt. Yes, we're going to be talking about what's going to be coming up in Paris at the Conference of the Parties. And unfortunately, for all the people killed and wounded and otherwise really impacted in Paris, and it's certainly created ripples around the world, and it's also going to impact the Paris climate change talks, apparently. Certainly, no one needed that. But nevertheless, I thought it was really important to carry on with this. And everybody who's going to be going to Paris, obviously, is going to be focused on the continuing discussion on climate change. And the Conference of the Parties is something that might be a little abstruse to people. It's part of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. It's the supreme decision-making party, a body of the convention. All states that are parties to the convention are represented at the COP, at which they review the implementation of the convention, any other legal instruments that the COP adopts, and take decisions necessary to promote the effective implementation of the convention, including institutional and administrative arrangements. Of course, that's bureaucratic speak, which I'm sure you're well used to. So how did you get involved in this? I guess first, talk a little bit about your background in economics.
Yeah, I've been working in this area for maybe, 35 or 40 years, actually, from a concern about environmental pollution problems going all that way back. And seeing the economy is a very key aspect of this, the conflict between the environment and the economy. And really, at that time period, nobody was paying much attention. And if you raised your hand as an environmentalist and said you actually worked in economics, everybody thought this was a really bizarre thing to do. But I persisted with it, and I specialized in air pollution, looking at air pollution problems in terms of acid rain originally. Maybe people can still remember acid rain and Ronald Reagan's kind of famous quotes about it's the trees that cause the problem. Canadians were very happy about that. And then I moved on to ozone pollution. I studied in British Columbia, and I went to Wyoming. I did my PhD in Wyoming because there were specialists there working on resource environmental economics. And I looked in, that's when I did my work first on the climate change in the late 1980s, and looking into the resource issues, but also the ethics of it, the intergenerational problems of it, and the global issues, the inequities that arise from all of this. And I kind of moved from there into issues around environment evaluation, how we value the environment, which is also some aspects of philosophy, but also then getting into human behavior. I study social psychology, and then I get into issues about power and power relationships, and got into political science and those kinds of issues. And then I also do a little bit of work on the philosophy of science as well, and the science-policy interface.
So I would say that's an impressive combination of studies, and it seems to qualify you very well for addressing the complexities of this issue. And so I'm really glad we're able to get you. I really appreciate your taking the time. So you kind of, in a way, you grew up academically with this field that you've adopted as your own, sort of.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. You know, so I was, when I was in my early 20s, as an economist, I thought we could solve these problems really easily. My biggest concern when I started training was I was going to be unemployed, because I really thought that we just had to stick a simple tax on it. You know, I bought what the textbook said. It said, if we correct the prices, the market will sort it all out. And I thought this was a straightforward issue, right? Well, it is in those terms. You just put a price on the pollution and it disappears and it's problem solved. The market's very efficient. Okay, well, it's taken me a little while to work out this is not the way the world works. And the problems have got worse and worse. And I've moved from problem to problem, and none of them have been solved. They're all still there. We still have acid rain. We still have ozone pollution at ground level. We still have the smogs. We still have the particulates in the atmosphere. We still have all the health problems. And a lot of them are a lot worse. They may not be in your backyard, but they're a lot worse globally around the world. You know, you just look at China. The smogs are like they were in the 1880s in London. It's really sad, you know.
So, the issue that you tackle in this paper that sort of forms the basis of this program for me anyway. It seems like you keyed in on this this issue of economic growth as being sort of the fundamental fallacy, which sort of you just touched on by saying that, you know, the idea that these market-based solutions could solve these problems, you know, were then at the time, however, 30 years ago you're talking about, and are still sort of the dominant approach by these, you know, United Nations and other institutional attempts to deal with these issues, and they didn't work then and they're still not working. And so this paper you wrote, again, Better Growth, Helping the Paris Cop Out, which is obviously a pun on the COP Conference of Parties, Fallacies and Omissions of the New Climate Economy Report. Now, talk about the report that you're responding to with this paper, from the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate.
Yeah, so this is a self-appointed commission of very powerful people, ex-presidents of countries, financiers, bankers, economists. There's Lord Stern from the UK, who made his name by writing a report on how he could calculate the optimal levels of greenhouse gases using global cost-benefit analysis. And what they're doing really with this report is they're claiming that we don't really have to worry about changing the system or addressing the capital accumulating economy, because we can actually have growth and we can save the climate. And, of course, the magic solutions that they come up with to do this are all around technology-based, total faith in markets and market systems, and really hoping that there's going to be, through investing billions in new technologies, there's going to be some kind of a magic bullet solution coming along from a technology that doesn't require you to actually address any of the fundamental issues that we know exist in the system and which we don't need technology to address. We don't need innovation. We know what to do. So it's a real blind. And the reason that it's going on, you know, the whole report is written basically by a very strong lobby group for corporate industry and the powers that are the fossil fuel industry that is really creating the problem in the first place. And what they're trying to do is say, okay, let's take this climate change issue and let's get some money out of it. Because what we can do is we can get governments to commit billions, if not trillions, into our research and development programs for getting new green growth, and they'll basically subsidize our research and development, and then they'll subsidize our building programs to build all the new coal-fired power plants or whatever it's going to be with CCS, carbon capture storage systems on them, and the system can continue with no changes fundamentally in it at all.
Well, you just mentioned, you know, you just said a whole bunch of things, but you mentioned carbon capture storage, but they continually put out these ideas as possibilities, like somewhere in the future, but then that actually hasn't been implemented anywhere yet, has it?
No, it hasn't been. The trial programs have failed to some extent. They've been shut down in the UK. The Norwegians were pushing it heavily. Their trial plant hasn't gone operational, and it's a missed technology for the future. It's had a lot of money spent on it. And it will only, even if it were to work, it would only address certain types of pollutants anyway from certain sources, right? You're not going to get carbon capture storage facilities on the end of your car or anything like this, right? So it only addresses a small amount of it. This, while it's a total dream technology, right, it's a myth, it's actually heavily embedded in the forecasts that are being used to inform the Paris conference. So you look at what they're talking about in terms of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change projections, and they are actually doing projections of basing their targeting around the potential for these types of technologies to be used. So they're developing policies that are based on mythological future technologies.
Isn't that some kind of a logical fallacy? Or
yeah, really. I mean, the other logical fallacy is that some of their projections would require you to have a time machine because they require you starting to cut emissions 5 years ago. So there's a climate scientist in the UK who's been doing a lot of work on this, and he says basically the IPCC scenarios either require you to have these dream technologies or a time machine.
So you just mentioned the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the, you know, the scientific group empowered to basically continue to put together all the best scientific information into, you know, some sort of comprehensive form and to model what they see as the climate in the future. And then, you know, on the basis of that, this conference of the parties gets together. They got together, you know, I forget when it started. Was it in Rio that this all started, or?
Yeah, that's when it started. Yeah, okay. The first Rio conference. Well, the IPCC came out of a series of meteorological and climate meetings from the 1980s. The climatologists and meteorologists were already very concerned and were setting up international meetings, and they had already fed into international government discussions. And there were some commitments at that time to cut emissions quite seriously, 30-40% from various governments. And then the IPCC was set up as an informative body to feed into the negotiations. So they're meant to be a traditional kind of old-fashioned approach to science, which is they're going to supply information into the process, and then the decisions will be taken by the Conference of the Parties, which is a political negotiating institution where they would negotiate the actual treaties and what might be emissions reductions or whatever regulations may come in. So the IPCC's role is to be the purveyor of neutral information into the Conference of the Parties.
So basically, you know, we've got the idea that, you know, we've got like several approaches towards dealing with climate change. You know, we've got like individual consumer choices so people can like choose to stop buying this or using, you know, their car or flying on an airplane or whatever. That's one. Another one is, you know, market mechanisms, you know, voluntarily corporations, you know, theoretically, like if the price goes up on carbon, then, you know, people will buy less gas or whatever. Then, you know, corporations can, you know, voluntarily go green and like choose to not continue to produce something, or, you know, that's another one. And then, you know, there's an interesting level of like individual initiative by cities and states, which actually, you know, Portland just did a ban on new fossil fuel export infrastructure and on increased oil trains going through the city. And, you know, different states have put their own mandatory miles per gallon, you know, on cars in their state and various other things like that. And then, you know, some would argue, and it seems like if there's going to be any serious attempt to deal with this issue on a global level, basically the Conference of the Parties out of the United Nations is pretty much where it's at. Is that accurate?
Well, there's different. I mean, I work in an institute which is called multi-level governance, right? So what you just described is what we would call multi-level governance. It means that there's different layers at which we operate. So we work on the local town level. There's one layer of government there. You know, the regional level, the states for you guys, the country, international. You could say roughly like that. So at these different levels, there's different mechanisms for governance. So the international level is one level. It doesn't mean that you can't get a lot more done at the local level or at the state level. And sometimes that's the best place to operate and to get things done. And if you look at what goes on at the conference of the parties, it's very much controlled already. I mean, the reason that I wrote this paper that you've mentioned was because it's really an indicator of the preloading of the whole discussion there. As you said, you know, I don't expect anything to come out of the Paris meetings. I don't think that they will make a big thing about what they've agreed. They have independent country targets now pushed by the United States for unilateralism. So nothing really big is going to happen in this area. Everybody's got their own targets that they're comfortable with. And if you look at them globally, they don't address the problem. So the Paris meeting is not going to help. And it's going to chuck a lot of money, as I said, into research and development. And it's a bit of a blind. So you take those other levels you discussed, right? Mm-hmm. You take the local level. You can do a lot of things at local level, but you have to, you know, then the market level is really, that's another blind in some ways. Market pricing for these kinds of things is relative. It only works relative. If you change the price of something relative to something else, then it becomes more expensive relative to other things, and you substitute. That's the logic of the market. Carbon is in everything. Every single product you have, right? So you start pricing carbon, you change all the prices in a very unpredictable way. You don't know how it's going to change. And also the market model doesn't take into account power in the market, right? The power of the producers to pass on costs, to shove costs on to other people. And the little producers, the ones who can't pass on costs, lose out in the game. So it's a very biased system once you start doing the pricing. And then there's kind of individual choice, consumer choice in the market. Well, this is, again, it's partially a lie, right? So you become a green hedonist rather than a typical normal, you know, growth hedonist, and you're meant to feel good because you bought the right products. But that's not going to help, because if we're looking at the overall level of emissions and material throughput, if you still have a green growth economy, it's still a growth economy. It's still got energy and materials going through it, and the planet's not going to be any better off. Now, the other side of this is that the focus on climate change is, of course, in itself problematic, because it's not the only environmental problem. It's just one environmental problem from the same system. And it's also being used to avoid discussions, which we had in the 70s and 80s, about environmental problems in general. And environmental problems in general, which link into social problems as well, and social exploitation and these kinds of things, would then ask you, you'd have to say, well, we've got to actually look at the system level. What's wrong with the system? It's not just one problem, it's a whole bunch of problems, and they have the same cause. So these are playing around the edges. If you do the pricing, it's not going to help you. If you do the individual consumer choice, you've got this lie that individuals determine the whole system, and of course they don't, because there's structures. So you've got to address the structural level, which means you've got to look at how the economy and the society is structured.
Well, let's get into that a little deeper as we go along. This is a call-in show, as I told you. So, you are listening to Professor Clive Spash all the way by phone from Vienna, Austria, where he is a professor of Chair of Public Policy and Governance in the Department of Socioeconomics at Vienna University of Economics and Business. And we are talking about the upcoming Paris climate talks, otherwise known as the Conference of Parties under the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. And Professor Spash, like me and many others, is very skeptical of anything coming out of this, yet you are still interested in exposing the contradictions within the approach that they're taking. So I'd like to talk about that. But let's go to Sean first.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Paul, I wonder if your guest has ever had this experience. He's there in Austria, and as we all know, the Austrian School of Economics is all the rage in this country. Von Mises and Hayek have been popularized by Ayn Rand and that bunch. But I wonder if he's ever had this experience where you're talking with someone who supports free markets, who's a supporter of capitalism, and you try to pin them down and you say, well, but the railroad companies in the 19th century, they buy the Congress. The defenders of the free market come back and say, well, that was crony capitalism. That wasn't real capitalism. We have some sort of pure capitalism in mind. And what you're referring to is crony capitalism, when your guest this morning has already indicated that crony capitalism is capitalism. There's no getting around that fact. They socialize the costs and privatize the profits. That's what capitalism is. And so it's impossible to have a conversation with supporters of free markets because they won't admit to that fact. And so from my perspective, the only system that ever tried to stop this death cult called free market capitalism is the old Soviet Union. From my perspective, a command economy, 25 years ago, the end of the Cold War, it's been a complete vindication of the command economy. And people that say, well, the Soviet Union had terrible environmental problems, well, that's not fair, because the Soviet Union was desperate to protect itself from this death cult called free market society.
Well, let's let Professor Spascia address that. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. So, and of course, the Austrian School of Economics is committed to a free market approach, but it's like the mainstream economics school. It doesn't pay any attention to the environment, where its resources come from, or where they go to. And as the caller says, it's cost shifting is an essential part of the way the capitalist system operates. So you push costs onto others, you outsource, you go to countries. If the American environmental standards get too high, if labor standards get too high, if health and safety standards get too high, you go to another country, you go to South America, you go to India, anywhere, right? You outsource, you go to a country that you can control and where you can basically exploit labor and the environment. So this is a very clear aspect of it. They also, these mainstream economists and the Austrian schools who are pro-market don't talk about power and power relationships, which are an essential part. I mean, we're talking about political economy here, and in the 1800s, the political was removed from the economy, and this is obviously a clear mistake, because there is no such thing as a divorce of economy from politics. It's all about power and power relationships. In terms of a planned system, right, well, I would say if you take the logic of the mainstream economic approach, and they say we have the prices wrong and we have to internalize the costs of the pollution damages. Just take carbon. As I mentioned earlier, if you try to internalize the costs of carbon externalities, you would change every single price in the economy, right? Once you've changed every single price in the economy, well, who does that? Who does the calculations? Basically, it is an admission that the market system does not work, and that you have to plan it. So it is a planned system, but it's a planned system already anyway. What does a multinational corporation do? Does a multinational corporation, some of them bigger than countries, do they internally run themselves on the basis of some free democratic process with markets internally? No. They are top-down oligarchies. And these are the biggest players, right? Something like half the planet's wealth is going through these organizations, which are already, we could call them totalitarian dictatorships, if you want. So they're already existing. This is the world in which we already live. In terms of the Soviet Union, though, I wouldn't rush down the route of saying that they didn't pollute their environment. They did pollute their environment, and quite badly, and their approach was no better than the Western approach in terms of its care about the environment. They exploited resources to the full. There's all sorts of reasons why. Yes, of course they were involved in an arms race, and the arms race is part of the problem that goes straight with the military-industrial complex, right? Which was pointed out by Eisenhower. I mean, it's Eisenhower's phrase, a Republican-American president who, in his closing address to the nation on television, points out the danger of the link-up that has happened between industry and the military, and that how this is a threat to democracy, a threat to American democracy. A Republican president, a general, a Second World War general, is warning the American population about the military-industrial complex. And we have it today, right? It's stronger now than it has ever been.
And it just seems to keep reinforcing itself as it spreads insecurity and failed states around, that then it sets itself up as the savior of the situations that it creates, which is seemingly analogous to the Conference of the Parties and the attempt to deal with climate change through continued growth, which somehow will magically produce the solution to the problem that it itself created. It seems somewhat paradoxical, and you know, those of us and you at a level that I will never even aspire to be in terms of, you know, actually being able to synthesize information and put out articles and operate in spheres that are at several levels removed for what I am. I think we're trying to do somewhat the same thing, which is to point out the contradictions, explode the contradictions. Do you tell, you know, obviously you hold out some hope that it's possible to do that, or you wouldn't continue to write papers like you did. What sort of, you know, reverberation do you actually get when you make these attempts to sort of subvert the process from within?
Well, I think I try to work on different levels, you know, so I'm trying to look for alternatives, but a lot of the time I spend deconstructing other people's positions, because that's the state of the world. The reaction to my work has been everything from banning it in Australia. I was a senior civil servant in Australia. I work for an organization which is called the CSIRO, Commonwealth Scientific Industrial Research Organization. It has about 6,000-7,000 people working for it, all sorts of scientists across the board. I wrote a paper criticizing emissions trading schemes, and basically they banned it. And then I had to fight for 6 months. I was censored. I was harassed. And in the end, the case got talked about in the Australian Senate as a freedom of information issue, and the paper was released, you know, but I resigned my job and left the country after that. I was fed up with it, but it's not uncommon. It's become worse. It goes on all the time. The scientists are being gagged. I'm an economist, so, you know, they try to gag me. They didn't succeed. This is one aspect of the reaction, but what that tells you is that it's possible to actually have an impact. If they're so desperate to ban some obscure professor's papers, they must be pretty worried, right, about the kind of impact it can have. The truth, telling the truth about things can actually have an impact. So I am hopeful. On a good day, I'm more hopeful than on a bad day, of course. But I think that the majority of people are the ones who are actually going to suffer, the ones that are already suffering. 7 billion people in the world. Right? Of those 7 billion people, very few, maybe what, 5%, live in the United States and Europe and are well off on this system. What's happening in China does not make the Chinese masses well off. It's actually harming the majority of people. The same in India. People are being chucked off their land for growth, for the growth economy. So the majority of people are not benefiting from this system or the way the system operates. They are worse off, and they suffer from it. Right? So if the majority of the people will stand up and ask for change and start doing things, things can change. That's my hope, right? So I maintain this position. Unfortunately, the small elite that run the system are extremely powerful, and they do have the military on their side, and they do have the police on their side. So the structures are there, are very strong. But you know, we hope that we live in somewhat democratic societies, and that they could be made more democratic or truly democratic. And that's the struggle. And even if I had no hope, I would have no choice, because I think it's the only right thing to do.
Right on. I feel the same way. So let's go to another caller. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. That was a wonderful segue to what I want to ask you about, which is direct collective action. And there's a motif of this in this conversation of how the big structural, institutional organizations that manage production and then manage the oversight of production and these conferences and such. They are not reliable. They are not accessible. And they are clearly harming the majority, like you say. What do you think ordinary people, the majority, can do in a way that bypasses that and starts looking horizontally for power?
Yeah, I think the issue here is that we have to look at where the power structures are, but where the blocks are on the power. I'm in favor of direct action. I think it's becoming more and more essential. It's a personal choice. It can get violent, and it can. I've been on demonstrations and so on. We in Germany last summer, there was a big protest against brown coal, one of the dirtiest coals that you can get. The Germans, with all their rhetoric about how they're switching their energy sources to clean energy, are planning to mine out their brown coal in 20 years as fast as they possibly can. And it's a massive devastation, right? It's not as bad as the tar sands and the situation in Canada that you guys have in North America, but it's an equivalent kind of example of the exploitation and stuff. So direct action there was done, occupying the area, and you saw the linking up between the police and the corporate security services, working together against the protesters. But the protesters there were making a point more than stopping anything, but we need more actions. It's the only way I can see that we can actually raise the stakes in terms of the challenge to the power structures. Because, let's admit it, democracy is failing us. It is seriously failing us. You look what goes on and the decisions that are made behind closed doors today. We have so many decisions going on which the people just don't have any choice. Look what happened in Greece. They elected a government to take a stand. And that government was bullied into backing down and doing the opposite of what the people wanted. This is the situation we have. So when you get to this, you've got no choice but to take power into your own hands and start getting active. But, of course, we don't want to end up with violence. We don't want to have a bloody revolution.
Go ahead, Joe.
Can I ask one more thing off of that, because I have to now go. But... So when I hear you referencing direct action, the particular actions, it sounds kind of like coalitions of affected communities, and I'm wondering whether you think there is any workers' organizations out there that seem to be doing work or espousing the intention to do and organize workers in a way that you think mm-hmm. is going to be effective for actually stopping these systems, and they're material systems, so there's a material way to stop them.
Yeah, I think it's really a problem because the unions are not really on board on the agenda. There's discussions here in Austria and Germany trying to get negotiations with the unions to make them realize the situation and the problems that we have. But the unions are still very much in the growth mode, jobs and growth, and they're very much into that and not anything else. But you need more solidarity, and we need solidarity across, countries as well. There are people who have got workers' movements together in different countries for different issues, usually against resource exploitation, where agricultural workers are losing their jobs or the farmers are being pushed off their land, 125 million of them in India, 250 million in China. So there's some attempts for people to organize around this. It's a not so big level, but it could be increased. And these things are disparate, and you need more unity, I think, internationally as well.
Well, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. My name is Paul Rowland, your regular host here on Wednesday mornings during our talk radio slot, which airs every weekday from 8 to 9 with different hosts each day. And I'm speaking with Professor Clive Spash, a social ecological economist who's at the Vienna University of Economics and Business. And we are on the phone with him from Vienna, Austria today. And I did neglect to give out the number, but obviously some people already did know the number. It's 503-231-8187. We're coming up on 8:40 with 20 minutes left in the program. Time flies so fast. I want to ask Jim to hold on just a second, our next caller. So, you know, you talked a little bit about your evolution into ecologically economics, and you know, you talk about political economy, which is kind of, maybe you do that partly as a provocation, because I know it's sort of almost become a sort of an atavistic, almost taboo phrase. And you kind of explained a little bit about what you mean by that. It seems like people don't really want to link those two terms together, certainly not politics, economy, and ecology. So talk about how you came to be what you call a social ecological economist.
Yeah, so one of the problems I realized with the environmental movement, and even the people who started linking the environment and the economy, is that they lack a connection to real social problems. So you get a very similar common act of exploitation that goes on with both workers and with the environment, but the two sides haven't linked up. So ecological economics very focused on environmental problems, with ecologists initially, you know, being quite strong in that movement, and then linking up with economists. But where are the power issues? Where are the inequity issues? Where are the justice issues? They're in the background. They're not really being addressed. And mainstream economics doesn't do this at all, right? Because mainstream economics got rid of the power issues and all these injustice issues and other things, and it said, oh, we're just going to deal with efficiency. We want an efficient production system. I mean, this is just engineering, right? It's straightforward engineering. How much can I get out of the machine in the shortest possible time? That's the kind of efficiency thing. Whereas the economics that we want is meant to be the old-fashioned economics, which was Adam Smith's economics, which was about well-being. You know, it's the moral side of it, the attempt to actually create a better society for people. We don't want growth because we want growth. We want to have a prosperous and well-meaning society that, you know, actually people can live in and be happy and flourish in. And that's what we're aiming for. So if you want an economy where people can flourish, then it's a different type of economy. But the problem with the environmental movement then was that it's actually focused on the environment, almost against humans. And this is a problem. So the social, bringing the social in strongly, which is what I've been trying to do in recent years, is to make social ecological economics, is to say, look, the social issues are the same as the environmental issues. They are the same part of the system. There is the exploitation and the degradation. And if you address one, you will address the other. You can address both at the same time. There is no conflict here in terms of seeing where the problems lie in the system and then addressing them. So that's the aim with the social ecological economics. And also, as I was talking a little bit earlier, to get more solidarity and unity, in this case, unity within different movements that are working around their concerns, but that aren't really seeing the unity that is there.
So, you know, you mentioned something to go along with what you're just saying, really interesting. I forget exactly where I read it, but you're talking about John Maynard Keynes, and sort of along the same lines that he sort of was one of the, you know, the inventors at a theoretical level of the modern growth oriented economy. But as you said, he actually envisioned it only for 100 years, because he saw it as a necessary evil, this growth-oriented economy, in order to create sufficient well-being, I guess, to establish a level of material security and comfort, mm-hmm. so that, I don't know, what's the argument there?
So Keynes, in the 1930s, when he was publishing his general theory, which was basically to address the Depression, the Great Depression, which was, you know, we should pump money in and make the machine grow and save capitalism from a disaster at that point. He also wrote a very interesting paper called For Our Grandchildren. And in For Our Grandchildren, this is where he says, we will have to do this for 100 years. But unfortunately, when we make this system operate, we will get people who love money. The people who love money and who are really problematic psychologically, he even, you know, details it, these are the people who are going to be running the system, are going to be empowered by this system. But after 100 years, we've got to get rid of them. But he doesn't tell you how, right? So he dumps you with a system that runs for 100 years, creates a lot of growth and capital, and then it's like, well, thanks, guy. So how do we get out of this one? You know? But he says very strong things in this paper about the problems with the system and the type of people it's going to create and who's empowered by the system. And like you say, it was meant to be 100 years. The 100 years is almost up, right? So we've still got the system, and it's still running.
And unfortunately, maybe it is climate change and global sea ecosystem collapse that will actually bring it about, but obviously in a very grimly different way than Keynes had envisioned.
I think there's also aspects here which shouldn't be neglected is the resource wars that we are going through here, land grabbing, you know, the control of other countries, the exploitation that goes on in other countries. I mean, the reason you need a strong military is to make sure that your resource supply is secured and that you keep those resources and you keep them cheap by keeping the people suppressed in those countries. So we shouldn't neglect that part of the problem. I mean, maybe before you get to the ecological crisis, you have another world war. You know, the way things are going, there's a massive build-up of land grabbing going on. China's grabbing land in Africa. The West is trying to secure its resources as well with its military. And this is, we're back to geopolitics, you know. The fight with Russia over Corsican oil fields. You know, this is very typical old-fashioned geopolitical maneuvering to secure your resource base. So there's that side of it that shouldn't be neglected. The crisis is multiple. You know, we have social crisis, we have economic crisis, and we have environmental crisis. And the three are interacting with each other all the time. Which one gets us in the end, right?
Yeah. Well, we only have 15 minutes left, and this is going very fast, and this is a really extraordinarily in-depth conversation to the extent that we're able to in this amount of time. Let's go to our next caller. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, the current issue of The Economist talks about debt, the world economy, and so forth. And one of the bright spots, one of the countries that they were optimistic about was Argentina, low public debt. And they've been fighting a long battle for many years, of course, against Wall Street. And I don't know the guy's name, supporting Rubio, the billionaire. So it's an interesting country that's perhaps on the right track. Just your thoughts. Thanks.
Well, I don't know a lot about Argentina, I'm afraid. But I have seen what's been going with the BRICS countries. And basically, most countries have exactly the same model that everybody else has got. The push is for throughput of material and energy resources for a growth economy. Whether you have public debt or don't have public debt is beside the point. You maintain the system on the basis of the resources and the throughput, and that's what basically ends up with your economy being seen to be wealthy, to being seen to be successful.
So we've kind of gotten a little bit off the main track of this, and hopefully we'll be able to do a more in-depth conversation taped for later airing to really get into, as we lead into the conference of the parties coming up in a couple weeks in Paris. But just to get back a little bit to this this paper you wrote, Better Growth, Helping the Paris Cop Out? Fallacies and Omissions of the New Climate Economy Report, which was written by the Global Commission on the Economy and the Climate, which you basically refer to as a corporate lobbying group. Like, just get a little bit deeper into this. What is really at stake? I mean, you don't expect much out of the Paris talks yet what would you see? How would you see something different coming out of Paris? I mean, do you see, there's been in, I don't know if at Copenhagen, I think there was an island nation, someone from an island nation that got up and passionately spoke about how their country was in danger of being inundated by a sea level rise, and it, got some press. There's always something, whether outside or inside, that is a little bit off script. But, what would you see that might really shake up, that might really bring to the forefront the, the kind of truth-telling that you're trying to do here?
I think the problem with the Paris conference is also the way it's totally institutionalized as a negotiating process. You have professional negotiators here who have been to all the COP meetings, who are rented out and hired, and they do their negotiating. People like the small island states get some opportunities to push their emotive points forward and get them on the table for a very short period of time, and maybe that helps them get some extra compensation package or something like that. But it doesn't change the fundamentals in the dynamic of the meetings. You know, these meetings, they're not going to go to Paris and negotiate anything. They've been negotiating everything before they got to Paris. The reason that this paper I wrote was written actually over a year ago was because this report came out from this powerful lobby group feeding directly into the process of the pre-negotiation negotiations, where the deals were already made, right? The deals have been made bilaterally before the meeting gets there. They don't spend a week in Paris making important decisions. This is more of a publicity event. There may be some negotiations and minor things will go on, but the big decisions have already been made. And you can see them. That's why you read documents like this, tediously boring documents, I would have to say, quite often. But these documents give you a hint of where things are. They have a discourse in them. They have a framing of the whole problem. So what I did in this particular paper is to look at the framing, look at the way they've framed the whole issue. So they frame it all around corporate power. What's their biggest concern? Is their biggest concern about people being killed, flooded, dying in the future of devastation to the planet? No, their biggest concern in this paper is that if there's a real agreement, then the fossil fuel industry is bankrupt. Because the fossil fuel industry has so many assets that it cannot use. Basically, there's five times the reserves now that would take us over the top in terms of the 2°C target, which we've already exceeded and which doesn't save the planet anyway. So there's a massive amount of reserve assets that the fossil fuel industry has, which it cannot burn without destroying the planet. That means they're bankrupt. Their Wall Street price should be crashing, right? So the concern of this lobby group is to say, hey, well, we can have growth. We can still keep the carbon. You know, we can still burn all that oil. We can still go fracking in Canada because we got to maintain this growth machine. Otherwise, we're all out of business.
They don't actually come out and say that directly, though.
No, you've got to look at footnotes and stuff. Read between the lines, you know.
So before we go to Brett, our next caller, in the last 9 minutes of the program, again, the document that you're criticizing, you're referring to, was written in September 2014. It was called Better Growth, Better Climate, The New Climate Economy Report, the Synthesis Report. So the new climate economy, that's something I talked about with Corey Morningstar last week on this program. And she's actually the one that talked about you and got me to read some of your stuff. And through the magic of the internet and your willingness, I got you on the show. So that's something I'm going to be talking about more in the future. This whole idea of the new climate economy is why I called this program Ideology and Illusions in the Face of Climate Catastrophe. And as you pointed out, not just climate catastrophe, there's a multi-leveled crisis that we are in the midst of. But this whole idea of the new climate economy, that we can continue to have growth and save, you know, what's left of our tattered ecosystems and biosphere is such a tragic, I mean, there's something deeply, you know, it's like a Greek tragedy. You know, there's something very, very deep, culturally very deep about all this, despite the superficial language. I mean, that's the way I see it. I don't know. Do you?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, there's different levels here as well. I mean, the personal psychology, the way people shut things out at one level, and then there's the way that these the guys who write these kinds of reports are heavily embedded in the system. I mean, you don't become a member of the House of Lords in the UK unless you're heavily embedded in the system, right? So people like Lord Stern are really very much on board with the whole system and the whole game, so they're not going to question it. And then underlying this, of course, is a deep-seated fear, a psychological fear that if things change, what will I do? What will happen? what happens to me, what happens to my family. So you could, the fear of change is what keeps people trapped in the system and maintaining it. So they'd rather continue on with some blind hope that, okay, I know we're destroying everything, but maybe something will save us, then stop. Stop it and do something else, because that seems so scary. But then you head straight into a crisis, right? So we've got these fears. And unfortunately, the fear element is what's being played on so heavily since 9/11, you know, around the world. And it's really being used. It's a manipulative device to make people scared all the time, get them scared, go to the airport, get some scares, you know. I mean, it's really pervasive, and it's really pernicious, this kind of a use of the psychology on the individual. And it's used in the environmental movement as well, and it's used all over the place. But this is one of the problems. So how do we get a social ecological transition out of this? How do we manage to break the structures that are tying us down and also get over our fears and get over our psychological problems and say, actually, we should stop doing this and do something that's a damn sight better?
Well, collective action, to the extent that one is able to break out of our own individual isolation and find like-minded individuals, is, I find, a very good way. And I think in Portland, there is a really growing, and we're, you know, it's really interesting. It's being done at a lot of different levels. There's a lot of creative direct action. There's a lot of people working, you know, lobbying, working with directly our municipal leadership here to do, you know, some really unique, far-sighted, you know, who knows where it's going to lead. But I think it's really important, as you're saying, to do things at various levels. And just before we go to Brett, I'm glad you're holding on there. I want to mention a couple things in the spirit of taking more direct action, sort of on the wave of the, you know, the activism that's been putting Portland sort of on the edge role in terms of climate activism. The movement to stop liquefied natural gas export terminals on the coast has a couple opportunities here to intervene. One is a bird dogging Kate Brown event. That's how they say it. That's this Saturday, November 21st at 6 p.m. outside of the 2015 Democratic holiday party with Governor Kate Brown. It'll be at the IBEW Hall, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, 15-15937 Northeast Airport Way. From our sidewalk positions, we'll communicate to Governor Brown and her supporters why she should take a stand against the two proposed LNG projects in Oregon. Bird dogging is an effective and time-honored tactic used in communicated messages to elected officials. This action is family friendly and legal. Hands holding signs would probably appreciate gloves. They say dress for the weather. Contact Bonnie for carpool info by noon on Friday, this Friday, at 503-705-1943. There's also an email address if you want it. I'll be at the front desk after this program. You can call and get this information. Also, a meeting to plan the next plan of December LNG action will be this Sunday, November 22, from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House at 4312 Southeast Stark. Bring snacks if you can. There'll be coffee and tea. This Sunday, there will be the second meeting to discuss and plan the LNG action plan for December 10th or 11th. Please join us as we divide into teams and get active to bring more awareness to this important issue. And I don't actually have the contact number for it. I think it's lng@gmail.com. But again, contact me. You can contact me at paulrkboo@gmail.com if you want to get this information, or call me at the front desk after this. And we only have 3 minutes left. Let's go quickly to Brett. Are you still there?
Hi there.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks for having me, Paul. Hey, I wanted to touch bases briefly on a subject. It seems like there's this black hole around anyone that's informed talking about climate change, and that is the livestock. Seems like livestock is never mentioned as a key part of the you know, the change in climate. And
okay, we'll have to cut you off there because we only have a minute left. So, Professor Spash, do you have anything to say on the agriculture and the climate?
Yeah, I think that we should all be vegetarian. I'm vegetarian, right? So I think it's a good thing to do, not just for the climate, but also to free up land, to get rid of the meat industry, which is pretty horrible. And I think it has lots of benefits for your health as well. So I would recommend everybody become a vegetarian.
Okay, well, we're going to have to pretty much leave it at that as your last word. And again, I'm hoping you will be able to make a future appointment to have a more relaxed conversation to tape to get a little bit deeper into some of the issues we touched upon here today. I've been talking with Professor Clive Spash. Again, he's at, what's your website?
It's www.clivespash, all one word, no dots, .org.
So that's a CLIVESPASH. And again, yep. There's some of the links, and I'll put more links on the page for this program on our website, kboo.fm. Unfortunately, voluntary archiver mechanism isn't working, so I won't be able to put that up, but you can access it through going to the schedule and looking up Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you so much. I gotta run. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
A higher kind of love comes of age. Fire in the building. Something good burning away rage. Look through eyes of the painted face. Fire in the building. Warmaker smothers by his own disgrace.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Joe Hill Centennial Tribute Concert Thursday, November 19th, 7 p.m. at the Alberta Rose Theater in Portland. Joe Hill was a member of the Industrial Workers of the World and wrote the classic labor songs There's Power in a Union, The Rebel Girl, and many more. Joe Hill was executed.